In Iraq, the government is struggling.
There's no social services. There's no other services. There's terrible corruption. There's all sorts of things.
Into the vacuum, Iraqis are turning to Iran for help. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, longtime basketball commissioner David Stern has died. He made the NBA a global brand. Today, NBA players across the world represent their countries with pride.
They see that path through their athletes because they know that those are the individuals that can go and win global recognition.
Also, if you're not feeling good, maybe your yin and yang are out of whack.
Those needles are so sharp, you don't even know they're going in.
Yeah, that's a very good sign of twitching. We call it arrival of qi.
Traditional Chinese medicine getting some real international street cred. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It could have ended very badly. Thousands of pro-Iranian demonstrators chanting death to America attacked the U.S. Embassy in Baghdad this week. They set fire to a reception area and then laid siege to the massive diplomatic compound in the Iraqi capital. But on Wednesday, the demonstrators picked up and left. U.S. officials quickly laid the blame on an Iranian-backed group called Kataeb Hezbollah. Here's The World's Shirin Jafari with more.
How do we know that Kataeb Hezbollah was behind the embassy attack? For starters, it was the flags. In videos of the scene outside the embassy, some men wore military uniforms. Many of them carried the distinctive black, white, and yellow flags of Kataeb Hezbollah, which show a raised fist holding an AK-47.
It's literally the Hezbollah battalions. It's often called the Hezbollah brigades.
Philip Smythe is with the Washington Institute, a think tank in Washington.
That's where I specialize on Shia militias, and I have the Shia militia mapping project where I map out all the activities of all the Shia militias in the Middle East.
Smythe says Kataeb Hezbollah is closely connected to Iran, Iraq's next-door neighbor to the east. The group is one of Iran's most loyal proxies in Iraq. When it was formed in 2007, it was very small, with only a couple of hundred members. Then, slowly, it grew to a much larger, powerful organization. Kataeb Hezbollah also operates in Syria, Smythe says, and is strongly connected to the Lebanese Hezbollah. It's just one of numerous Shia militia groups in Iraq.
You know, you have under 100 groups that are kind of unofficial networks and also official groups. Official groups, it's closer to around in the 60s range. But when we look at this, you have to maintain the understanding that the Iranians are firm controllers of a good number of these organizations.
Iran's influence in Iraq goes way back, Smythe says. In the 1980s, the two countries fought a bloody war. But since the U.S. invasion in 2003, Iran has sought to increase its influence in its neighboring country, and it has specifically focused on the Shia communities. Why? It's all about regional power and ideology. Ayatollah Khomeini, the leader of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution, saw himself as the leader of all Muslims, especially the Shias. He also wanted to export Iran's revolution to other countries. Khomeini's legacy continues to this day. In Iraq, the Shiites are a majority of the country's population, but they suffered greatly during the decades of Saddam Hussein's rule. Saddam favored the minority Sunni population. So the Shiites in Iraq looked to Iran and its Shia religious government for support. Smythe says since the U.S. overthrow of Saddam Hussein, the Iranians have courted the Shiites in Iraq as their natural allies.
The Iraqi economy, you know, it's in the toilet. There's no social services. There's no other services. There's terrible corruption. There's all sorts of things. And the Iranians often come in offering a lot of money, offering a lot of political influence at times. If you are, you know, somebody who's from a very, very poor community, that certainly appeals to you.
The American troops on the ground witness these alliances on a regular basis. 38-year-old Jared Johnson served two tours in Iraq.
both deployments, I was there with the 82nd Airborne Division. I was an infantryman.
Johnson says his platoon knew it was dealing with an Iranian-backed militia group because they were the ones that stuck around to fight.
It was usually a higher coordination, more sophisticated weaponry. It's a much bigger deal.
Johnson says he wasn't familiar with Qatar, Hezbollah, until this week. But when he heard about the embassy attack in Baghdad, it reminded him of a comment that an Iraqi army sergeant had made back in 2009.
Oh no, if the U.S. leaves, then the wolves are going to come out and get us. And so they all laughed because what they felt was that that's the way that we thought of them.
By wolves, he says the sergeant meant the Iranian-backed militias. And he was being sarcastic because by that point, the Iraqis felt confident. They thought they could handle any security situation on their own. But of course, the Islamic State proved that wrong. Reflecting on this week's developments, Johnson says he can't help but feel sad.
It feels like we spent, as a country, and you know, me and you know the people I served with, so much time and effort over there that it's almost like a waste. It makes me sad. Just, I don't know a better word than that.
The leader of Qatar Hezbollah goes by the name Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Muhandis was born to an Iranian mother and an Iraqi father. He has lived and studied in Iran and speaks Farsi perfectly. Recently, Iranian state media aired a documentary about him. In it, the militia leader says he's proud to speak Farsi. Arabic is the language of the Quran, he said. Farsi is the language of the revolution. The American government was concerned about Qatar Hezbollah well before this week's attack. In 2009, the State Department designated the group as a terrorist organization. In the press release, it said Muhandis and his militia group, quote, pose a significant risk against coalition and Iraqi security forces. This week's events proved just that. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
In Australia, at least 18 people have died from wildfires since September. Others are still missing. And frustration with Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison is peaking. One angry Australian impacted by the fires called the Prime Minister an idiot to his face today.
You're an idiot, mate. Oh. You really are.
You won't be getting any votes down here, buddy.
You're out, son. You are out.
You are out. Morrison was touring the New South Wales town of Cobargo. A fire had devastated the area the night before, destroying the main street. Nearby, a father and son had died defending their home. At one stop, angry residents started yelling that they weren't getting enough support to fight the fires.
How come we only had four trucks to defend our town? Because our town doesn't have a lot of money, but we have hearts of gold, Mr. Prime Minister.
Earlier, the Prime Minister shook a woman's hand. Her response?
I'm only shaking your hand if you give more funding to our RFS. So many people here have lost their homes.
We need some help.
We need more help.
She said the RFS, the Rural Fire Service, needs more money. Morrison later spoke with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation about the clashes.
Well, I'm not surprised people are feeling very raw at the moment. And that's why I came today, to be here, to see it for myself, to offer what comfort I could.
He said Australians should be patient, calm, and have confidence in the emergency response system. Morrison has also faced harsh criticism for not doing enough to battle climate change. Scientists have predicted even more severe fire seasons as the planet continues to warm. Morrison has said it's not credible to link climate change to any single fire event this season and that there are many factors at play. The longtime commissioner of the National Basketball Association, David Stern, died yesterday at the age of 77. Stern is credited with transforming the NBA from a struggling league into a global brand. When Stern retired in 2014, after 30 years in charge, NBA games were being televised in more than 200 countries and in 40 languages. The tributes poured in today from NBA legends like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who took to Twitter to pay his respects to Stern.
He was a giant as far as the game was concerned. He helped everybody in the world learn about the game and enjoy NBA basketball. And I think he's responsible for the worldwide popularity of the game today.
David Stern also opened the door for international superstars to come play here. This year, NBA rosters are represented by players from 38 countries. Perhaps the hottest international player right now is a 20-year-old Slovenian. Esteban Bustillos, here at WGBH, has his story.
Lucas!
The game hasn't even tipped off yet, but there's already a crowd who have gathered to get a quick photo or autograph when basketball's latest messiah, Luka Doncic of the Dallas Mavericks, steps onto the court at TD Garden for warm-ups in Boston. There are signs, kids chanting Luka's name, adults using the kids as an excuse to get this close to Doncic, and others shameless enough to not even try to hide their intentions. Jack Krasminski is a 21-year-old Mavs fan who took a 2.5-hour train ride from Maine to see Dallas play in Boston.
I followed Luka Doncic when he was on Real Madrid, and when I saw they could get him in the draft, because a lot of people were doubting him, I knew he was going to be really good. I thought he should have went number one.
Doncic was the third pick in the 2018 draft. Like many Mavericks fans, Krasminski is all aboard the Doncic train.
Luka playing MVP level this year. He's only 20 years old.
In his first NBA season, he averaged 21 points a game and won Rookie of the Year. This year, Doncic is averaging nearly 30 points a game, currently third best in the league. He's also grabbing crazy rebounds and dishing out plenty of assists. The young Slovenian has already started a conversation about whether he could be the best player in basketball. The king of the NBA, LeBron James, has even heaped lavish praise on Doncic with colorful language you can't say on public radio. Now Doncic, along with Kristaps Porzingis, a Latvian superstar who Dallas acquired last season, are two of the biggest European names in the NBA. And they had Mavericks owner Mark Cuban reminiscing on another former Dallas duo when he spoke to reporters courtside before the Celtics game.
Yeah, in some respects, it's like Steve Nash and Dirk when they first got here and were young and learned to play together and pushed each other. And hopefully we can replicate their success.
That's high praise. German big man Dirk Nowitzki is a legend in Dallas and widely considered the greatest European player of all time. The 7-foot German led Dallas to its only championship back in 2011. And now the expectations are already building for Doncic to follow in his footsteps. Tim Cato covers the Mavericks for The Athletic, a sports website.
It's a very international-facing organization that does spend a lot of time overseas, scouting overseas, looking at players from, you know, other countries, because they have seen that as somewhere that they can get a leg up on other teams.
Cato went to Slovenia to report on how Doncic's home country is responding to the rapid rise of the NBA's next potential leading man. Cato says that while the country is small and young, it broke away from Yugoslavia in 1991, it has an intense amount of pride, and its people are still seeking validation on the world stage.
The way they do that is through their athletes. They see that path through their athletes because they know that those are the individuals that can go and win global recognition. And with the way Luka has risen into global superstardom, you know, they have all rallied around him. Even the non-basketball fans, you know, are just as supportive of him because he's the one who's getting the pride of their country out into the world.
Now, he's on the biggest stage of the basketball world. During the game in Boston, Doncic moves with grace and precision, whipping no-look passes like a chef with deadly accuracy. Whenever he has the ball in his hands, the arena's just a little quieter, for fear that if you're not paying attention, you'll miss out on seeing something breathtaking. In the stuffy, hot visitors' locker room after the game, he's soft-spoken around the gaggle of reporters who have waited to see him.
Are you worried about fourth-quarter free-throw shooting?
I'm not worried about it. Just things happen, you know.
The interactions are mostly the usual post-game boilerplate questions. There's also Slovenian reporters following him. Doncic looks like he's ready to go home. He's the last one in the locker room. After a few minutes, the Mavs PR team shepherds him out. There wasn't a chance to go into deeper questions about being the next great European ball player. On this night, questions were just about the game. And that seems fair. He's only 20 years old. But he navigates the game and everything that comes with it with an elegance of someone much older than that. And he's doing it all while carrying the pride of a small European country on his back. For the world, I'm Esteban Bustillos.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. Turkey is flexing its muscle as a regional power. First, it intervened in Syria. And today, the Turkish parliament approved a plan to send troops to Libya, across the Mediterranean, to North Africa. Libya is in the midst of a complex civil war. The Turkish troops are being sent to support the government in Tripoli. The government there controls the capital, but not much else. It is a dramatic move, but is part of a pattern by Turkey to reach out more broadly to many parts of Africa. Ambassador David Shin is America's former top envoy to Ethiopia and Burkina Faso. He now teaches international relations at George Washington University. First of all, Libya. Why does Turkey care about Libya?
I think it's more historical than anything else. The fact that Libya was once part of the Ottoman Empire. I think Libya is sort of going through a neo-Ottoman phase that sees a particular attachment to this part of the world. There may also be some interest in hydrocarbons in the wider region, and particularly in the case of Libya, there is an economic agreement between Turkey and Libya. This is with the Government of National Accord in Tripoli. President Erdogan of Turkey would like to be sure to implement that economic agreement, and should the Government of National Accord fall, then that agreement will come to nothing.
So what is in it for the Libyans if it sounds like hydrocarbons are in the back of Erdogan's mind?
I think the Government of National Accord is reaching out to whatever support it can get. And there aren't that many countries that are providing tangible support and particularly military support. So I think it's really a question of national survival for the government in Tripoli.
So you mentioned, Ambassador, the historic context for these Turkish troops going to Libya. I mean, Erdogan, he does like to invoke the memory of that once great Ottoman Empire. Do you think this is in some way an attempt to start rebuilding that empire or at least create the optics of one?
Well, it would be a question of rebuilding the optics of it. I don't think there's any thought of re-establishing the Ottoman Empire with control over territory. But there is a desire to establish Turkish influence throughout the former Ottoman area, which covers, of course, all of North Africa and extends into parts of sub-Saharan Africa. As a result, you've seen a major effort by Erdogan to reestablish Turkish interests throughout all of Africa, including those parts that had nothing whatsoever to do with the Ottoman Empire. It varies enormously country by country. Turkey does have significant investments in countries like Ethiopia, Sudan, some of the North African countries. They're very engaged politically in Somalia, and Somalia is one of the countries that's gaining enormously by Turkey's engagement there.
And what does that mean? What are they actually doing in this relationship with Somalia?
Well, in addition to providing political support, they actually have a military facility in Mogadishu with a couple of hundred Turkish military personnel that train Somali National Army personnel. This is a major investment. Essentially, Turkey has sort of opened the door for Somalia. It's offering numerous scholarships to Somali nationals, and about half of all Turkish aid to Africa has gone to Somalia.
Wow.
So the impact in Somalia is enormous.
So establishing relationships is one thing, but actual boots on the ground, I mean, how unusual is it for Turkey to send troops overseas like they're doing in Libya?
I think it's very unusual. I think Turkey's going to learn that this may be a more difficult situation than simply training Somali National Army personnel in Mogadishu. I really wonder how this is going to play out.
Ambassador David Shin, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Staying in this part of the world, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu wants immunity from prosecution. He was recently indicted with bribery and fraud in three separate cases, and he's now asked the Israeli parliament, the Knesset, to effectively skip a trial while he's still in power. In a televised announcement last night, Netanyahu said that the immunity law is intended to protect elected officials from being framed. Netanyahu often calls the allegations against him a politically motivated witch hunt. Yohanan Plesner in Jerusalem is the president of the Israel Democracy Institute. He's also a former member of the Knesset. Plesner says Netanyahu does not seem to have enough votes in the Knesset to get immunity, but just making the request is expected to delay the start of the trial by several months.
It's unlikely that this Knesset
that has already dissolved itself will be able to discuss this request. So we're in a very unique situation. First time that a prime minister is under indictment. First time they choose to request immunity. First time that the Knesset goes for a third consecutive election without being able to form a government. And this obviously has a lot to do with the prime minister trying to avoid his legal proceedings.
So you're saying he's buying time, and he's buying time to get that majority in the Knesset that he's not been able to get so far.
Yeah, there were two. The first round of election in April, second round of election in September. In both rounds, the prime minister did not gain a majority, and neither did the blue and white party led by Mr. Gantz. And surprisingly, the polls now indicate that we're expected to reach an outcome of a third tie.
So if you expect another tie in a third election, then definitely there will be a fourth one, won't there?
No. If I have to bet based on my decade and a half long experience in Israeli politics, a government will be formed one way or another.
The suspicions against Netanyahu, which became official corruption charges in late November, they first came to light in the summer of 2016. And at the time, Netanyahu said confidently that, quote, nothing will be found because there is nothing, end quote. So how did we get from there is nothing to Netanyahu asking for immunity? Is there now evidence against him that amounts to a smoking gun of corruption?
Yes, there is evidence that merits the submission of an indictment. Mr. Netanyahu's claim now is that this indictment is politically motivated and therefore it should be annulled. There's no evidence whatsoever to support this claim. But Mr. Netanyahu's continuous pronouncements that try to undermine the legal process in those institutions does seem to have some support in Israeli public opinion, especially among the political base that supports Mr. Netanyahu himself.
I don't know if you saw this, Yohanan, but Benny Gantz, Netanyahu's main rival, said that the prime minister is endangering the values on which we were all raised, that every man is equal before the law. That is very similar language to what we heard here during Donald Trump's impeachment hearings. Congressman Jerry Nadler said again and again, no one is above the law, not even the president of the U.S. Do you think Netanyahu believes he is above the law?
That's exactly the problem with the use of the immunity tool. That's actually a tool that increasingly is vanishing from the democratic world. Also in Israel, immunity, since the current legislation was put in place more than 15 years ago, was never used and nobody gained immunity. Mr. Netanyahu, the narrative that he uses is that there was impartial treatment towards him, but essentially the way he conducts himself demonstrates that he thinks that he's above the law. But Israeli law enforcement institutions and the judiciary are still strong and can ensure that justice is served.
Yohanan Plesner, the president of the Israel Democracy Institute. He's also a former member of the Knesset. Thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Sesame Street is celebrating 50 years. It's a global brand. In Afghanistan, the writers and puppeteers have an especially tough job, help kids deal with conflict and war.
We talk about fear, disappointment, anger, and how to control that. We talk about empathy.
Sesame Street in Afghanistan, that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. We saw how huge the story of immigration policy was in the United States last year. To begin with, of course, there's President Trump and his wall.
For many years, people have wanted the proper wall, and we have a wall that the likes of which very few places have ever seen.
There's also the Central American migration crisis. Thousands of migrants from Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador streamed north to the U.S. border. Many were detained in Mexico. As for the next 12 months, the world's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, joins us to look ahead. First, some news on this front just today. Democratic presidential candidate Julian Castro calling off his campaign, and that ends a progressive bid that really emphasized immigration reform, really put the issue front and center.
It certainly did. He by far had the most detailed immigration plan among any of the candidates. And in some ways, what we're seeing is that speaking about immigration and immigration policy in a nuanced way can be tricky. In the last two debates among Democratic candidates, immigration has largely been absent. We still don't see the leading candidates speak about immigration in a nuanced way. It's easy to say that they'll reinstate DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program that started under Obama, which is under threat and in the Supreme Court, right? It's easy to say that they'll reinstate DACA day one through executive order if they win the next presidency. What's harder is to say, how will they treat another mass increase of migrants at the U.S. border? How will they rework the U.S. immigration detention system? Those are trickier proposals. Those are trickier conversations.
What are the biggest issues with immigration that you see coming up this year?
What I'm really interested in looking at is the relationship between the United States and Mexico, because Mexico has worked really closely with the United States. But now this could get much trickier because migration from Mexico is increasing. And this may be a bigger issue this year. People are fleeing their homes and leaving extreme violence in Mexico in larger numbers. That violence does not look like it's going to de-escalate. And we're starting to see small protests recently in Tijuana led by Mexican migrants saying, you know, this is very frustrating. We're waiting in our own country.
It occurs to me too, Monica, that Mexico has also worked with the U.S. on the Remain in Mexico program for migrants coming from the Northern Triangle, especially. You've reported quite a bit on this program. Remind us what Remain in Mexico is and where we're actually at with it.
What we're going to be watching this year is the legal fight to end this so-called Remain in Mexico program that allows the United States to send asylum seekers back to Mexico to wait on the Mexico side of the border while their immigration court cases play out in the United States. So you have people waiting on the Mexico side for months, and we're seeing these migrants on the Mexico side face extortion, kidnapping, robbery, rape, because they're waiting in some of the most dangerous parts of Mexico.
To bring us back to Donald Trump earlier in the interview, I expect Trump will continue to bring up the border wall in pretty much every campaign speech he makes. What should we expect in terms of actual construction of this thing?
I mean, we definitely can expect Trump to repeat his signature issue to build more wall, so-called wall, along the U.S.-Mexico border. Recently, the White House restated its goal for 2020 for about 450 miles of new border wall. I think the reality of that is going to be wildly different. We saw that in 2019, the Trump administration only managed to build about 1 mile of new fence, of new barrier. They replaced a lot, but new border wall? It's still very, very, very little. So I think it'll be difficult for the Trump administration to achieve that goal.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, thanks very much for doing this.
You're welcome, Marco.
Now, when you go to the doctor, you might get your blood pressure or cholesterol checked, but what about a yin deficiency in your kidney? A traditional Chinese medical practitioner could check this. The World Health Organization is now recognizing some of these practices, but in Europe, not everyone is on board with that. Here's the World's Ilana Gordon.
Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
I'm Kwan. Nice to meet you.
Kwan Zhou leads Michael Campanelli into an exam room. They're at the New England School of Acupuncture in Worcester, Massachusetts.
You know, I had one of those workouts where you've pushed yourself too much. This time of year, when the winter hits, I get seasonal affective disorder. So it could be both the mind and the body.
How is your, like, sleep?
Zhou is a traditional Chinese medicine practitioner. She trained in Beijing and says she was first drawn to the ancient roots of a practice that's still highly respected in Asia.
And let me see your tongue, please. Thank you. It's not rosy red enough. So it's like pale lavender. So it's a deficiency of yang. The yang is not strong enough.
Zhou views a person's health through the connection between the body and nature and a philosophy of yin and yang.
Yin is more nurturing, cooling, calming, and the yang is active, hot.
Health problems are a sign of imbalance.
So I'm preparing the needles.
By this point, Campanelli is lying down on his left side on an exam table. Zhou places very thin acupuncture needles in his cheeks, the back of his neck, and his hip.
Those needles are so sharp, you don't even know they're going in.
He feels a twitch.
Yeah, that's a very good sign of twitching. Yeah. We call it arrival of qi.
Mm-hmm. Joe says chi arrives through different channels of energy called meridians.
We summon some soldier to work for us.
This session may seem quite different from a standard medical appointment, but on the global stage, meridians and chi are having a moment. For the first time, the World Health Organization is including a section on traditional Chinese medicine in its upcoming guide for diagnosing and classifying diseases.
This shows the world is multidimensional. So this is great.
Song Chin Ki is a traditional Chinese doctor who has been practicing in the UK for 30 years. He says he hopes the new WHO manual will promote his field around the world.
Or even hopefully let this medicine play a bigger role for people's health or prevention.
But the new recognition is fueling an uproar among top science and medical groups in Europe. Dan Larhammar is president of the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences.
Well, we were quite astonished to see something like that, which has no scientific support, to be included in a document that is so widely used across the world.
Larhammar chairs a coalition of European Academies of Science and Medicine. The group issued a warning about the WHO's decision.
Because if unproven methods are claimed to be useful, then we are risking the health of the patients.
His group is calling for more stringent regulation of traditional Chinese medicine across Europe, and specifically a crackdown on claims of some herbal remedies. Larhammar says the World Health Organization runs the risk of legitimizing quack assertions about cure-alls for cancer and other diseases.
Nobody has been able to define a meridian or an acupuncture point. No one can say what diameter an acupuncture point has or how deep it is in the skin. It's still totally unknown. And the most likely explanation for that is that they probably don't exist.
We need to be open-minded. Each kind of medicine has its own merit, so we should learn each other.
Song Chin Ki, the traditional practitioner in the UK, says medicine of any kind should strive for best practices to filter out quacks. He hopes the World Health Organization's update will help advance that.
World Health Organization is about the world, and it's a health. Health can be many, many forms of the health system.
In a statement, the WHO said the inclusion of traditional Chinese medicine in its manual is not an endorsement of any practice. The point is to be a universal system to track and understand health around the world. Dominik Ehrnich is a doctor at the University of Munich. He heads a pain center at the hospital there, and he's also president of the German Acupuncture Association. Ehrnich has been following the uproar in Europe and thinks there's reason for it.
But on the other hand, it's a little bit exaggerated.
Ehrnich says there is some medical evidence for certain traditional approaches, like acupuncture for chronic pain.
For example, in Germany, it's well accepted by most likely the patients and many doctors because they are very familiar and they use it.
But he says it's best incorporated under the umbrella of modern medicine, where it can be scrutinized and where practitioners have backgrounds in science, too.
So I will do a little popping on your back.
Back inside the Massachusetts clinic, Quan Zhou places glass cups on Michael Campanelli's back. And they suck the skin inside. She says it's to address a stagnation in qi and improve his circulation.
That made the blood vessel relaxed, so that wake them up to have them do better job for you.
Is this the kind that Michael Phelps wore as a swimmer?
Yes, yes.
Campanelli seems satisfied.
Have herbs in front.
On his way out, he asks for a special herb that he says helps with his allergies.
Not having to take a pill for every ache and pain, I'm absolutely a believer in it.
Does your regular doctor know that you do this?
No, he does not. No, he doesn't, but I probably should tell him.
Campanelli drove up an hour for the appointment at this acupuncture school. He says it was worth the trip. For the world, Alana Gordon, Worcester, Massachusetts.
More tension in North Korea. Kim Jong-un declared Wednesday that his country would unveil a new strategic weapon in the near future. It's not clear exactly what Kim has in mind, but some analysts have suggested he's threatening to test a nuclear weapon in space.
That is an incredibly dangerous and provocative step that undermines the security of the entire world. I think the U.S., not only the United States, but the international community would have to have a very robust response.
But it might be something else, too, says Ambassador Wendy Sherman. She's a former U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. Sherman had firsthand experience negotiating with the North Koreans during the Clinton presidency.
Kim Jong-un has played President Trump like a Stradivarius violin, quite frankly. I think Kim has used the photo opportunities with the president to gain credibility internationally, while at the same time buying time to develop more strategic and sophisticated weapons. Whether he has in fact achieved what he stated in that statement after the party meeting remains to be seen, but I have no doubt that Kim has continued development, even as he has restrained his testing of nuclear weapons and long-range ballistic missiles, testing which I think is likely to begin again in the near future if diplomacy does not take hold.
I mean, Kim has surely taken advantage of the photo op. I would say President Trump has too. We have to go back, though, to the start of Trump's tenure. I mean, policy did seem more serious. The White House was successfully pressuring China to rein in North Korea. I mean, don't you give the administration some credit for having at least some bones to begin with?
Look, I supported the president meeting with Kim Jong-un because in North Korea, only the leader matters. And the president of the United States happens to be a president who believes he's the only one who matters. And indeed, he was the one who was elected president. So I supported that effort because I thought it might break through. It has not been successful, though it has stopped the testing of long-range ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons, which is a good thing, but not enough to stop the development of their nuclear program to build more sophisticated technology, because so much can be done on a computer without actually testing the weapon in the atmosphere. So yes, I think there was the potential of a positive start, but there really hasn't been any progress anywhere since that initial invitation to work with each other.
So how would you define, Ambassador Sherman, the current U.S. strategic policy toward North Korea?
I think that's very hard. It's very hard for me to really understand what the strategic policy is in any of the president's national security and foreign policy. But if I were to take a guess, it would be to try to avoid war, find a diplomatic way out. Steve Biegun, who is now Deputy Secretary of State and remains the point person on North Korea, is a very capable professional. And if there is a way forward, he may be the person to find it if the president gives him the space, the team, and North Korea agrees to in fact have working level negotiations. We probably won't get to denuclearization anytime soon, but we certainly can take some interim steps to cap their program, to restrain their efforts, and to try to move towards denuclearization.
Right. In the meantime, Kim has said that North Korea is going to start mass production of nukes. What is your overall takeaway from Kim's speech at this end of the year party meeting?
Well, I think that it shows that Kim is in full control. Those party meetings only happen when the leader calls them, and they're a bit Potemkin, a bit unreal, in fact. But I think he's saying, okay, I'm in charge. I've got what I want. I'm going to proceed forward. I am a nuclear power. Do what you want. Say what you will. Happy to have continued conversations that apparently aren't going very far. But be clear, I'm not going to stop doing what I need to do to ensure the survival of this regime.
Help us understand what Kim Jong-un really believes in. I mean, does he believe so strongly in the philosophy of communism that he's ready to destroy his country and much of the Korean Peninsula?
He believes completely in his regime, in the dynasty that was created by his grandfather after the Korean War. He believes that denuclearization means that the United States should make sure that it can't use nuclear weapons on the Korean Peninsula, even if they are not currently on the peninsula, that they can't be launched from submarines or from airplanes on the Korean Peninsula. So for him, it's about the United States ensuring the survival of the dynasty his grandfather started, and for Kim to, in fact, be sure that he stays in power. So it is not so much about communist ideology, but rather the ideology of Juche, which is self-reliance, that North Korea doesn't need anybody to do anything. It is in charge of its own destiny.
Ambassador Wendy Sherman, the former Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks, Marco.
Peace negotiations are expected to resume soon between the U.S. and the Taliban. A peace deal in Afghanistan had seemed almost within reach for a few months now. The Trump administration had even invited Taliban leaders to Camp David for peace talks back in September. Those were reportedly canceled after an American service member was killed in Afghanistan. This week, more steps forward and more steps back. Violent clashes continued between the Taliban and Afghan government forces. A Taliban spokesperson tells the world that it has not agreed to a ceasefire despite the rumors. The Taliban says it will reduce violence, but only after a date is set to sign a peace agreement. Let me talk about another very different form of American diplomacy in Afghanistan, one that has remained consistent over the past few years, Sesame Street. The American Kids Show is celebrating 50 years, and in that time, Sesame Street has been seen in most countries around the world. Sesame Workshop has created 30 international co-productions. The World's Sarah Birnbaum looks at one of Sesame Street's latest productions, this one in Afghanistan.
Bache Simpson, which means Sesame Garden, is not just American Sesame Street dubbed into local languages. It has its own writers and producers, it has its own sets, and it has its own Muppets like Zari.
Salam dostay aziz! Man Zari hastam az baghche Simpson!
A spunky six-year-old who models female empowerment. And it has live-action segments featuring local kids. The show gets funding from the U.S. State Department, and it teaches letters and numbers, but it also advances other international development goals, like girls' education. Think Sesame Street as a form of soft power. This is a live-action segment featuring a Hazara family, which is a persecuted ethnic minority in Afghanistan, and it's called First Day of School. It starts with a little girl. She says, "My name is Zainab and I'm 6 years old." Then Zainab's dad packs her school bag. He kisses her cheeks, showing that the male authority here endorses sending his daughter to school. Then Zainab's parents give her a blessing, showing that Islam also supports the education of women. Anwar Jamili heads an Afghan team that develops content for the show.
Our team responsibility was to bring the Sesame version into Afghan context.
Jamili has been with the show since practically the beginning, and at first he says he was really nervous because most of his writers and producers didn't come from children's programming. A lot of them were reporters or documentary filmmakers.
I was worried because I and my team had the experience of programs for adults, but not for children and particularly preschool age.
So he went to New York to take a class at Sesame Workshop. Jamili learned how to construct a show and promote what you could call Sesame Street's core values: fun, optimism, tolerance. And then he had to go back home and make that work in a conflict zone. This is the approach they decided to take.
It's a positive modeling. We do not talk for the negative modeling.
Meaning no mention of violence, no mention of the Taliban, no mention of ISIS. They focus instead on things like emotional health.
For example, we talk about fear. We talk about disappointment, anger, how to control that, empathy, hope.
But you don't show the violence or you don't reference.
We don't show the violence. And we would like to go through positive because that works.
This is not unique to the Afghan Sesame Street. In the American episode about September 11th, they never talked about terrorism or the Twin Towers. Instead, Elmo sees a grease fire at Hooper's store. He's too traumatized to go back in.
Are you all right?
Elmo doesn't want to go back into Hooper's store.
Oh, hey, it's okay. It's okay. There's nothing to be afraid of. The chief said that the fire's out.
Elmo doesn't care, Alan. Elmo doesn't want to go back into Hooper's store.
But then Elmo learns how to process his fear and moves on. This approach, using metaphor and highlighting resilience, works for Anwar Jamili. But he says not everyone on his staff was on board, that some people on his team wanted to address directly what was going on around them.
You know, some of the people, for example, saying that we should talk about the suffer that children have from the fight and from poverty. But then, you know, we also talk that we would like them to be happier. This is the goal.
And it's a good goal. But the approach could also have some drawbacks. Naomi Moland is an anthropologist at American University and the author of Can Big Bird Fight Terrorism? A case study of Sesame Street in Nigeria. She says Sesame Workshop's own research suggests it's important to be direct with kids.
I think one of the main findings is that parents and educators don't talk enough with children about race and poverty and difference and tolerance and religion and all these different things, and that we should be talking with children more explicitly about these topics so that children don't just see these topics as taboo.
But Mullen says that can raise another issue because those overt messages are often controversial. Take, for example, Sesame Street in Nigeria.
Saying that we should be friends with Christians if we're Muslims and we should be friends with Muslims if we're Christians. You know, those messages may lead parents or families to believe that the show is trying to push them into some sort of tolerance or coexistence that might not be feasible or tenable given the current conflict in the country.
And that's a dilemma that's unlikely to go away anytime soon, especially in Sesame Workshop's newest international co-productions, one for Syrian refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, and Syria, and one for Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
Around the time that Sesame Street lifted off here in the U.S., this Afghan musician had already reached stardom back home. Afghan singer Ahmad Zahir is no longer with us, but in the 60s and the 70s, he was known both as the greatest Afghan singer of all time and the Elvis of Afghanistan. Zahir used a lot of psychedelic arrangements, so I'm not so sure about the Elvis comparison. This song is titled Tuba Mani. It's the refrain Zahir keeps coming back to, meaning, you're with me, you're in my heart. And that's where we leave things today. But you can connect with us first thing tomorrow morning in your inbox. Our morning newsletter, Top of the World, starts your day with fresh details from stories we're covering across the globe. Sign up to Top of the World by heading to theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's theworld.org/newsletters. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.